The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are not necessarily representative of any other entity. This content is intended for mature audiences only.
Yo, 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 what is going on, people? Welcome to Throw Down Your Questions, episode 578. I'm your host, Tony Polanco, and tonight I'm joined by Emilio Lopez.
Sup, people? How's it going? Apparently, he has risen.
Carlos Romero.
Yo, yo, yo.
Brett Murdoch.
What up, people?
Richard Bailey Jr.
What's up, everybody?
And Brian Manjoma.
What up, what up?
All right, guys, we're back. Another one. Since I'm trying this new setup, let me know how everything looks and sounds. I think we're good, but it's always good to get your feedback. And as you can see, I was able to flip my image. So for you guys watching the stream, I should be fine. Although I could double check because now it's looking kind of fucked up on my end. Like, wait a minute. Anyway, questions. Let's get into them. It's kind of ironic. The main question is actually saved it for the last, but it's all right. George W. Cush starts us off. What's up, guys? Happy Easter. I wish you good times. Here are my questions. First one. This one's a little bit of a long one, so let me get through it. How do you deal with open world games with too much content? Since becoming a father, I have been playing more Nintendo games because I feel they respect my time. I tried playing Final Fantasy VII Rebirth 3 times now, and it's just too much. The game makes me feel like if I skip the side content, I'll be missing a lot. But at the same time, the list of things to do in the open world is too much, and that Chadley dude can't shut up. On the one hand, I love Final Fantasy, and I wanted to finish the remake saga. On the other hand, I feel like Square Enix has prioritize quantity over quality, and I'm scared of wasting my time. Sorry for the long text, but I wanted to give a clear example. So the main question is, what do you do when a game interests you, but you feel it's too much? Do you force yourself through the story, or do you leave it? It's a conundrum, you know, of open world games, right? Here's the thing, Final Fantasy VII Rebirth is not an open world game, but it may as well be. It may as well be how big it is. And they definitely crammed it with too much shit. And it's also the reason why when I played a certain amount of Crimson Desert, I checked out. I'm like, this game is great for what it does. I respect the ambition. Way too much for me. So that's my answer. Check the fuck out. You're not under any obligation to finish a game, you know? Unless you're reviewing it, but you're not, obviously. So, you know, if the game is too much, check out. Your life is too short to be wasting it on something you don't want to do. And you say you got a kid too? Nah, man, that's your priority. Not a video game, you know? Like you said, Nintendo's respecting your time. So I would seek that. This is why, you know, like I said a couple weeks ago, I'm more inclined to play games like Resident Evil Requiem. 12 hours, I'm good, you know? Obviously, you know, other people's times are different. Their lives are different. So that's just my solution to it. But what about the rest of the panel? How do you guys manage giant open world games?
I don't play them.
There you go.
With the exception, like the last open world-ish game that I played, it was Spider-Man 2. But I feel like that game does a better job of being respectful of your time than a lot of open. I have the first... Like, I just feel like a lot of times it just feels like busy work for the sake of busy work for a lot of those games. I'll even say this about the media darling, Red Dead Redemption.
Two.
As soon as I started playing that game, it just felt like a lot of work more than just like me playing through the game. So I just said, you know what? I think maybe I'll play it in the future. Maybe I won't. I just feel like, especially since my time is sort of precious, I have other things that I need to do and I can't. I don't want to. I know some people want to immerse themselves in a world, but some, you know, just want to, you know, you just want to, you know, dip in and then dip out, you know, have a nice little ending and then just move on to the next thing.
Yeah. Brian, get in here because you're currently playing Crimson Desert and I'm pretty sure you're going to stick with it until the end. So what are your thoughts on this?
It's an interesting question, and I've actually been having some thoughts about open world games recently. And, well, firstly, I do understand where the guy's coming from, because again, if you have lots of life obligations, then games is always going to be somewhere else rather than life stuff. So I fully understand that. But then I'm kind of stuck between this idea where, again, I've come to the realization, like years ago, back when I played Gone Home, that not every game is for everyone. And I've basically, I have accepted that as a idea. And I feel like games like Crimson Desert or Red Dead 2, like these massive world games, that like they're not for everyone to play. And that's a good thing, because obviously there's other games that you can play. But since the question is about this type of game, how I am tackling it, because I also don't have that much free time, is I'm treating it like a long-running TV show. By long-running, I mean, like, imagine you're going to be watching The Walking Dead from season one all over again. But rather than just binging it, where you're watching 10 episodes a day, you watch one or two episodes a day, and that's it, right? So kind of piecemeal it rather than trying to tackle everything all at once, because it will just consume you. That's kind of the whole point of these type of games. So if you're just doing like, okay, I'll do one or two quests a day and then just put it down. At least then you are tackling it bit by bit rather than just jumping all in, and it doesn't feel as time consuming. And as Tony said, if you are not enjoying it, you can always just stop. Plus, the cool thing about a game like this is that unless absolutely you have to, you're not forced to do certain things if you don't want to. I mean, right now I am befriending a bunch of cats so that they can carry around and loot stuff for me on my behalf, which I think is fantastic. And again, the game allows you to do that, but if you don't want to, then you just ignore that whole system. There's like a whole thing about dyeing your armor and whatnot. Again, if you don't want to, ignore that whole system. So again, it's kind of like a long-winded version of Tony's answer, where if you don't want to, then you can stop playing it. But yeah, I think just piecemeal it. Do 1-2 hours per day. I say 1-2 hours. 1 hour per day or something. Do one quest. And then that's like that quest for the day or that quest for the weekend. And then just keep going to it. Obviously, it means that you'll have to be interested in the long run. But again, it's a weird trade-off. Like, are you trying to finish it in one weekend? Or are you just trying to enjoy it for what it is?
Yeah, that's a good answer.
I mean, also the other thing, you know, like to go on with what Brian said, is also there is also no time limit on how long you will be playing a game. You know, you could take as long as you want. Granted, there is the possibility of, you know, people spoiling things or FOMO that could be adding to some additional pressure to the playing of that game. You could just be like, okay, that's my game to play for now.
Yeah. All right. What about the rest of you guys? Open world games, how do you manage?
I have a weirdly different view than everybody else. I know that's going to come to a shocker.
Brett, different view?
Who? I would question if you did absolutely agree. I'd be like, who is this person that just took over Brett's body?
Okay, so like, I guess I would reverse the question and ask people like, why y'all on a mission to do all of your vacation at once? Like, why are you trying to burn through your happy place like that?
Yeah, keep going.
No, that's the question. Like, if video games are where we go to unwind, right? Like, go to relax. And some of these big games are kind of designed like theme parks. That's like trying to go, like, that's like being like, I'm going to go to Disney World. I could buy a 5-day pass, but I'm going to try and burn through it all in one day. Like, all you're doing is diluting your own experience and ruining your fun so that you have less of it down the road. Like, I literally don't see an upside to rushing this.
Yeah. What if, you know, I have to throw this at you. What if he doesn't want to spend theoretically the rest of the year playing one game when he could instead play multiple games? And he, remember, limited amount of time, games. But then he's putting the other one aside, right?
Yeah. Yeah. and tacos are not steak. That's that games are different. Games are different. If you're like, hey, why is my giant open world game not a quick drive-through game? Brother, I got bad news for you. You ordered the wrong thing.
Yeah. Okay, so in other words, don't play open world games then.
Well, especially not like Crimson Desert. Like that game is literally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, like don't play Crimson Desert. Don't play Assassin's Creed. Like these games are meant to be hundreds of hours of deep, like, and yeah, like I get a little pissy about this because basically you're coming to somebody else's festival and being like, oh, this is, why is this 3 days? This should only be one day. They should close this down after one day. Like, bitch, just leave. Like, why are you trying to come in and piss on everybody else's Cheerios? Just go do something else. If a giant open world game is not for you, that's okay. But, like, yeah. Why do you want to change it for the people who do enjoy that?
I don't think he's insinuating that, by the way.
No, I'm not saying, I'm sorry. I'm using him as a stand-in for, like, the general approach to a lot of people, that a lot of people have this, is they want to take something that they kind of like and sew it to fit exactly what they think it should be. Instead of saying, you know, this is kind of something I like, but also not particularly everything for me. Like, I like lots of action games, right? I love Dark Souls. Does everything need to have that difficulty? No. Do I like when things have complexity and weight to them? Absolutely. It's you can have both, right? So to me, when people are like, hey, well, how do I deal with being in this open world game so long? Like, I don't know, man. Like, that's the whole point. It's a place to be. It's not a thing to do. Nothing to finish. Like I feel like you're conceptualizing it wrong. And I would be with that challenge to everybody. Like when you're walking into a game that is literally called, you know, designed as a theme park, like that's the philosophy and the mindset behind it. Why are you trying to rush through a theme park?
Yeah, I guess that's the answer. He'll have to, you know, something he'll have to answer. Go ahead, Manny.
I'm asking everybody in this panel.
Well, I'm not rushing. I take your advice. I dip out. That's my advice.
My way of dealing is that I don't get involved.
Yeah, and Brian's like, I'm in for the long haul. So I don't know who you're asking in this panel, dude.
It's not exactly saying that. Well, I guess Bizarro Brett has, because he does actually kind of agree with it. Well, everyone is.
Yes, you do. Anyway,
I kind of forgot Tony had adopted bailing. I'm like, hey, yeah, all right, good. Like, I fully endorse bailing.
Yeah, I'm with it. Your life is too short. Listen, Brett, I'm getting older every fucking day. And I'm like, because before 10 years ago, when you first met me, I'm like, I got no choice. I got to eat this fucking elephant. Now I'm like, then I eventually went to eat the elephant one bite at a time. And I'm like, don't eat the elephant. That's where I'm at now, you know?
Yeah, I don't think it could be, but I also think there is also the pressure of, you know, may not be overt pressure, but just zeitgeist, you know, since the zeitgeist, this is the bee's knees, that where everybody's talking about Crimson, and there's a lot of people that want to try it out because of the FOMO of what is going on currently, right? Everybody's talking about it, right? Oh man, this sounds great. Oh man, it's a 50 billion hours long. I feel like it's not only pressure. I think it's also pressure of just wanting to be a part of the conversation. And I think a lot of times what happens to people is that it's okay to not be a part of the conversation. I get it. Everybody else might be playing it, but that doesn't mean it's right for everybody. Just exactly what you.
Yeah, I think okay, we all agree.
While we're here, if you'll grant me this, and I know you don't love this, but if you'll grant me a hypothetical, I think I want to frame an interesting phenomenon and ask about it.
Okay.
Sure. What's up?
Okay. So you come out with a game that is just 6 hours of action-packed, high cinematic gold, but done in an open world kind of environment. It's not the biggest zone, but you know, it's a compact open world, but it bangs. But if it's like Order 1866, 6 hours of high fidelity, action-packed, pure nonstop, high octane awesomeness, right? We're all on board, right?
Yeah. By the way, I'm going to let you go with the hypothetical, but there's actually a game that fits your description, and it's not a hypothetical game, but go on.
Oh, what is this?
It's Miles Morales. 5 hours open world, and you can beat it. Full of shit. Okay. So there you go.
Okay. Now you take that same game, and you surround it with 5 new zones and 400-plus hours of side quest. Do you want to play it more or less?
I'll play until I'm sick of it. I think that's my answer to this hypothetical.
Yeah, I mean,
it's like, hey, listen, I love burgers and pizza, but there's only so much.
it takes some of the shine off the apple, doesn't it?
Oh, it absolutely does. I was going to say, again, my original answer was going to be you just diluted it, but then I'm trying to stay to the spirit of your hypothetical here.
The whole point, the whole mechanism that I'm pointing out here that I find fascinating is you reach a point where giving people more makes them feel worse. And it's,
yeah.
It's this weird difference between like expectation and reality. Like if you don't frame your expectation, you could hand somebody a gold covered steak and they're just gonna be like, why is it this color? Like it's the framing is so fucking important. And I think it belies a critical lack of communication between the companies and the fan base that is often the crux of the problem. But I just find it really interesting that, you know, you could jump in and like, cause my mind immediately goes to, well, the solution should just be, you should have a tied in, you know, short form main story. And then the ability to just kind of play around in the game forever after that or before that, not have a problem. Kind of what Skyrim actually stumbled into. But then I realized, I'm like, but that automatically makes people feel like they have to do everything. And it doesn't matter if it's got a, you know, it doesn't matter if that same 6-hour main story is the exact same. If you place it inside a bigger thing, suddenly people are unhappy. And I just find that fascinating. I don't even have an answer for that. I'm just like, I see that. I see what's happening. And that's weird. And that's about it. Thoughts?
Yeah, no, it's interesting. But we do have more questions here. So let's not dwell on this one too long. Unless somebody else wants to jump in on, you know, the open world stuff. Actually, Rich, I want to get your thoughts on this. How do you manage open world games, especially, you know, as a game reviewer?
Well, that's a phenomenal question. obviously as a game reviewer, if you're trying to cover a lot of stuff because you want to be able to talk about a lot of different things with the readers. So clearly you can get into an open world game, but most times in my case, I'm getting into the game so I can see all the systems, all the different things that it has to offer. Now, you made a comment earlier about Crimson Desert, the game of this generation, apparently from what I've heard from everybody on the internet. That is a game that I saw how much time people were putting into it. I said, I cannot get into this game because there's too many other games coming out. And I don't think I would have finished the game in time for April. So I didn't even bother to touch it. But again, depending on what the game is, I'll definitely make time for it. And I look at that the same as I'll know whether or not I'm into a game once I either see it or I've had a chance to check it out and try it, then I will know whether or not I want to spend more time with that game. At some point, I do want to check out Crimson Desert. I will wait until after all the patches have been released, and yes, this game is great across the board. But it's always something to think about with the open world games. But obviously, GTA 6, I will be there day one. I must apologize. I will be there day one.
Oh yeah, that's the exception to the rule. You know, like GTA, you know, can't evade that one. All right, let's move on. Another one from Mr. George W. Cush. Kind of related to the last one. Which game has your favorite open world that never felt like a chore? For me, it's easily Elden Ring with Red Dead Redemption and Breath of the Wild as third. Ooh, those are good. Red Dead Redemption 2 was definitely a good one. Because I think what it is they don't bombard you with stuff. It's all very slow. So, you know, you don't feel as bad. But to be honest, I think my favorite open world, just because of its brevity, is... Hold on. I almost forgot about Elden Ring. Elden Ring is pretty fucking good. Again, that one doesn't overwhelm you. It's not throwing 50 million things at the fucking map. You got to discover shit on your own. You know what? I think that is my answer. Elden Ring, you know, that's the really good open world. And shout out to Spider-Man 2 because it's New York, so it's easy for me to get around. I know where everything is. You know? What about you guys? What's your favorite open world that doesn't feel like a chore?
As me, who doesn't care that much for open worlds, I would say I liked the Spider-Man world. You know, I feel like it felt, you know, big enough to feel like a city, but also small enough to where I didn't feel like I was, you know, like I didn't feel like I was working.
Yeah,
I could feel just the way that game does it in general. Like there's always something sort of going on, whether it be the little side missions of you fighting some of those street thugs or some of the other things. It always sort of keeps itself alive. And not to mention the traversal of that game, you know, and all of those spots is always really cool. Like swinging around is fun as fuck for hours, you know. Another one that is an open world game that is
By the way, don't feel obligated to list three. He did, but you don't have to. Just throwing that out there.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, because I can't. I mean, I guess RPG games like Dragon Quest is not can't be considered an open world, even though it's a fairly open world. Yeah, I would say at least that one. And I also say Vice City, but those Rockstar games are probably the biggest offenders of me not caring for open world games, because I feel like those games are often fairly sloppy, and also again it's like I sometimes just don't feel like driving all the way over to the other side of the map to do a mission. Why can't I just zap there and just do the mission anyway? Yeah, and then I did mention Red Dead Redemption 2, but I did like the world of Red Dead Redemption. It didn't seem nearly as vast as that later one, and it felt more manageable than 2. So yeah, that would be my
cool. All right, I'll go down the line here, Carlos. What's your favorite open world setting that doesn't feel like a chore? And again, you're not obligated to list three.
Okay, so I'll list four.
There you go.
I'll just say the obvious one, and it's going to be mentioned a lot, Elden Ring, and it's already been mentioned by Tony. Elden Ring is an easy choice. I mean, Fallout 3 is another one. It's just a world where it's pretty massive, but traversing everything doesn't really feel like a chore. It feels more like exploration. The anti version of that is Starfield. And I'll get a shout out to Burnout Paradise.
Well, that's a good one. All right, Brett, what about you? Favorite open world games that don't feel like a chore?
100% Elden Ring. That's just my happy place.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's a weird happy place, right?
Yeah, no, it's great, I think about the game almost every day, man. That lets you know something. All right, Brian, what about you?
Ironically, I think Manny as well. Manny and I are the only ones who have not played Elden Ring. So, again, also kind of loops back to the last question where you can just ignore the Zeitgeist game and just put it in the background and say, don't care. My three are Burnout Paradise, which is a really good call. I honestly didn't even think of that until Carlos talked about it. Dragon's Dogma and Shadow Mordor.
Ooh.
I think that was possibly the perfect size for an open world game. It's something that you could run across in maybe 10 minutes, but there was always something there, and it was very dense for what it was, and it didn't need to be any larger than what it was. Shadow of War was too large for what it needed to be, so yeah, hence why I say it may be the perfect size.
That's a good one. And Rich, what about you?
Man, some outstanding picks. It's going to be hard to follow this, but I'm going to say one I'm surprised wasn't mentioned. Cyberpunk 2077.
Ooh, that is a good one.
Yeah, because that game, obviously, we talked about that Phantom Liberty DLC. That really made me get back into the game, and is just, they did a phenomenal job. Let's just hope that when they release the next Cyberpunk, there's no issues at launch. But we'll see about that. Yeah, Cyberpunk 2077. I agree 1,000% with what Manny said about Spider-Man. That the funny thing is, Spider-Man and Ghost of Tsushima. I got the platinum in both of those games. So obviously that would tell you that, I wanted to do all the activities, and I made sure I did everything to get those platinum. So those definitely are my top three.
That's a good criteria.
I'd also agree with the Ghost. That one, well, it's also one that didn't feel like it was trying too much. It felt it was good enough to get you get your bearings in the world, and it wasn't so vast where it felt like busy work. I feel like that's my biggest issue with most open world games, is that a lot of the fetch quests and all the thing to do to push the game forward just feels like another job, and that to me is not. It's like, okay, we're just wasting your time, so you don't feel like you wasted your money.
Yeah, that's a good point. All right, let's move on. Asir in Air Force. He goes, hey, everyone, hope you had a good week. Yeah, it was good. I had the week off, so it was very good. I actually wish I had taken 2 weeks off. I don't want to go back to work. But got to make that money, even though I was paid, obviously. All right. First question. When was the last time? Okay. And Carlos, you need to be my translator here because I'm not sure if I fully understand this question. The question is, and I didn't really edit this one. When was the only thing I changed was Sony to PlayStation. When was the last time PlayStation had a presence in Japan? Because my immediate answer was like 1994. Like, I don't understand. When have they not had a presence? But maybe he means like, when was the last time they were dominant in the video game industry? Because obviously Nintendo's been eating their lunch for a while in Japan. Maybe that's the question he's asking. Is there enough for sure in the chat? Is that what you're asking? Like, when was the last time PlayStation was dominant in Japan? But anyway, Carlos, you could go first.
Yeah, and I don't even know what the numbers are for the PS5 in Japan. I mean, we at the beginning were like, yeah, it's not going to do as well as the Switch because those consoles are way too big for those apartments.
Yeah. You know, because I know in the beginning, and for a few years, PS5 struggled in Japan. Probably struggling more now with the price hikes, you know?
No. Oh. Yeah, so I don't...
Yeah.
The way I understood the question is... sort of, you know, when were they last dominant in Japan? Yeah. So maybe it's, you know, PS2 days. That's probably the last time.
Because yeah, you're right, because it can't be PS3. The Wii was fucking dominating during that time.
Oh, yeah, the Wii took over.
Yeah.
So I think that's the last time. The other way to interpret the question is, when is the last time, you know, Sony or PlayStation
had made headquarters?
A whole bunch of Japanese games.
That's the other one, by the way.
Wait, with the headquarters. Yeah, that's the other one.
That was the other one. Yeah. Sure enough, you gave us a lot of interpretations with this question, brother. I didn't even think about the Japanese game part, you know? I don't know. But for now, we just go with the dominance. And yeah, PS2 days. I mean, I think that's pretty much it. But yeah, as to when last time they had a presence in Japan, like a physical headquarters. That was during the early PS4. Actually, it was during the PS4 days. And then I believe it was towards the end of the PS4 or beginning PS5, they moved over to America, which was a bad move, you know?
Jimbo.
All right. Okay, moving on. Another question. With prices now surging for the Legion Go 2 and the PS5, will the Asus Xbox Ally, Xbox Series X, and Switch 2 go up before the end of the year? Yes, yes, and yes. Absolutely. They're all going to go up. Get ready. Just the way things are now, you know? I mean, I don't think anyone's going to disagree with that. They're all going to go up. They already have gone up. The Switch 2 is the only holdout. The Xbox Ally has already gone up, I believe. Xbox Series X already went up. Switch 2 is going to go up. Yeah, absolutely. And now some of these motherfuckers are probably looking at PlayStation like, oh, they went up twice. Let's go. It's crazy. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't. So they said Switch 2, ROG Ally, and what was the third one?
Xbox Series.
Oh, Xbox Series. I mean, Xbox Series seems like the least likely, but it's still likely.
Yeah. It happens.
I feel like the ROG. Yeah. I feel like the ROG and the Switch 2 are like for sure going to go up like that. I have no doubt in my mind those two will go up.
Yeah. It's crazy, man. Jolly Yellow Nerd, similar question. A few weeks ago, it was rumored that Nintendo was slowing production of the Switch 2. If true, do you think that this and the plans to lower digital prices are latchless efforts to avoid raising the Switch 2 console price? We actually talked about this on the Thursday show, so I don't know. I'm not sure if you saw that segment. And we concluded, generally speaking, that they are lowering the price of digital games to potentially like make the price hike of the console not seem as bad, you know, to kind of like temper it a little bit. You're right. It's still not confirmed yet, but that's what I believe is happening. They're lowering the price of digital games. So people are like, oh man, it sucks. I got to pay more for this console, but at least the digital games are cheaper. That's what I think is happening, you know? But again, check out the segment on the Thursday show. We went into depth about that, so I don't think we need to go over it too much. All right, his second question here. With Bond Spencer out and Asha Sharma in, I know people are rushing to judge whether she is suitable for the task of reviving Xbox. Obviously, it's too soon to tell, but how long do you think we should wait for her own plans and actions to take effect so we can see her in action rather than just being the face of what Bond Spencer left behind? Good question. So what should be her grace period for, like, okay.
She's got 5 years. That's it.
5 years?
Yes. Five years is normal development time for a game. So anything coming from now and 5 years later, that will be, you know, when they, we start seeing those games 5 years from now, that's the true point when we start seeing what she's actually doing. Because that is the development. That anything that she okays right now, that in 5 years we will see that.
Yeah. What about other things like lowering the price of Xbox Live and maybe some other things? Like, what about that?
Yeah, those are actually, yeah, those would be her own decisions, because those were not things that were set in place by Phil and Sarah Bond. But I think to be honest, five years is, we not only got a taste of what decisions she's making in the current space, but also an idea of, you know, what things she's finally okayed. What does she think that the future of Xbox is? And we'll only really see what that is.
Yeah. Yeah, when games start coming out.
Which is insane to say.
It wasn't like that before. You know, when Tom Kalinske came in, within the year, you started feeling those changes, you know, at Sega. But you're right about that. For me, I'm generally going to go with that. I'm going to go 4 to 5, which is what I gave Phil. But again, and it's not because I'm trying to give her a running space. It's just, it takes so goddamn long to make games now. That's the fucking problem, you know?
Yeah.
What about the rest of you guys? How long do you give her?
Well, we gave Phil like a 10-year grace period.
Not me.
So, but you know, in terms of for Sharma, yeah, I feel like 5 years is fine. But you know, like you mentioned as well, you can see things coming to fruition way earlier. There's a lot of decisions that can be made that can affect Xbox for the positive during this time. We'll see if those, you know, if those come into fruition. But, you know, remember the last time, you know, the last CEO of Xbox was, you know, Phil Spencer, and we gave him, he had an artificial grace period added because he kept acquiring studios and we kept adding those 5 years every time.
Shit. That's a good point.
Oh,
you know, it's funny. So remember, Sharma, go ahead. Finish your point.
If Sharma, you know, keeps, let's say she gets Ubisoft or something. It's like, you know, let's add 5 years to that buffer.
Oh, shit. That's a good point. You know, it's funny, man. I did a Tony's take on this many, many years ago. I think it was over 10 years ago where, you know, at that point, the conversation was, should Phil Spencer be fired? And when I was filming the video, before I started filming the video, I was like, yo, he just got there. And then I realized, oh, wait, he's been here 5 years and nothing's gotten better. So I think that's fair to give her 5 years, you know, just like I did with Phil. But you're right. Generally speaking, Carlos, he did kept getting artificially inflated or whatever, because they kept buying all these studios, you know.
And then they just kept saying, oh, sure, I'll be honest, most of Phil Spencer's tenure time at Xbox was wait till next year.
Yeah,
he's been waiting
the entire thing.
So I mean, I think he did well for whatever he did, but at the same time, it's like everybody's waiting for this supposed megaton and they never lived up to any of it.
Yeah, you're right. What about the rest of you guys? How long do you give Asha Sharma before you're like, okay, bitch, what are you doing?
I heard Rich say 15.
Damn, Rich.
No. I think what Manny said is 100% correct. Maybe 5 years, but I will add this caveat. I think that after this year, which is obviously the 25th anniversary of Xbox, people are definitely going to start to wonder, okay, what's next? Because we already know all the things coming this year. This is stuff that has already been in the works beforehand, obviously. So when you start to get into whatever is announced, whatever happens next year, you have the console coming out, all this other stuff. I think people will start to look at her a little bit more closely and wonder, okay, so what other stuff are you working on now? We already know Phil and the other regime, they were the ones that announced these other titles in this console. They were the ones that were working on this stuff. So what do you have for us now? So I think Manny is 100% on the ball when he said 5 years. But I do think people are going to start to be talking about okay, where are you at in the next 3 or 4 years?
Rich, let's just be honest. People are going to start saying that next year. On Twitter, yes. You already know. Yo, what's she doing?
Yeah. I mean,
she ain't doing shit.
Well, Chris is doing it right now.
You know?
Whoa.
Yeah, he is.
The whole thing with what's it called? With Sharma is like, we don't know how, because if the, you know, a lot of people speculate that she's pretty much doing that transition from Xbox, like, we're getting rid of this and you're our you know, captain in the ship that's going to take it to the undying lands. It's like, maybe that's what that is. But if she's really trying to save Xbox, I'm curious to know, like, how fast we'll get those announcements. And I predict that we're going to get whenever we get new bosses or new owners of teams and stuff, and sports teams, they usually like to spend a lot of stuff just to, you know, be like, oh, I'm doing things differently, and, you know, I'm paying for this, paying for that. So I'm curious if she'll do something like that. Be like, oh, we're lowering the price of Game Pass. But I mean, if she says, oh, Game Pass is $50 a month now, that's an easy way to say, no, this is not it.
Yeah, right. Or again, she could do the opposite, lower it. And you know what'll really win people over, at least the hardcore Xbox? No more, you know, actually, no, excuse me, exclusives are back. You know, back on the menu, boys.
Oh, yeah.
you'll
get Tim Dog back.
And that's something that could happen. You don't have to wait 5 years for that, you know? That's not going to happen, obviously, but that's something that could happen fast.
Yo, Tony.
Yo.
If she says Call of Duty is exclusive to Xbox, I'll be like, Dirk. I'll vote for her. I want to see what happens. I want to see the fallout.
Yeah, right. Oh man, if that happens, we may have to do an emergency throwdown. That's gonna be crazy. Mm-hmm. You know.
To be honest, I think they should do that.
They should have done that from the beginning. Yeah, exactly.
But obviously PlayStation got all pissy because they're one of their deal cash cows is all might get locked up under something.
Jambo.
Yeah.
Brian, what do you give her?
Give her 5 years. Because again, I think that's a standard amount of time. So potentially let's see where she's at towards the end of the next generation.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think towards the end of next generation, everything will be all on her shoulders. So we can see, because again, a lot of the start of next gen, end of this gen, is pretty much stuff that Phil set up. So I think the end of next gen will be her ground.
Yeah. What about you, Brett? How long do you give her, Mr. Murdoch? How much?
2 years.
Okay. What's your reasoning behind that? Because that's not bad either.
That's exactly why. Do you think Xbox is going to look like they're cycling through their management? That makes them look inept.
Well, according to Chris, Sharma's palliative care.
I mean, it depends on how quietly they can shuffle them off. If they seem like they're hemorrhaging talent, closing studios, and losing top executives, that scares the shareholders.
Yeah. Okay, so you don't even think she'll have enough time to actually turn things around? She might just, you know, get the axe early?
No, I think that they're, even if they strip her, like, they may take away all her power and sit her in a corner room for 2 years while she, you know, pretends that she's in charge while executives pull her strings, but she's going to sit in that seat for 2 years.
All right, that's an interesting take. But yeah, I guess
they do that in Japan all the time.
They definitely do that. But I mean, like how long do you give her until you're like, okay, bitch, what are you actually doing with this division?
Well, I mean, you got to look at it from a cost benefit analysis, right? Like, what is her salary, and what is it worth as a PR stunt or movement to pay to not have the public facing embarrassment of changing your executive guard?
Yeah, I wouldn't know.
Oh no, you can actually probably mathematically map that out, and I would virtually guarantee you the money that they would lose by the drop in stocks due to the confidence of investors would be greater than her yearly salary. It's more than worth it to just leave her where she is, the same way Sony kept the rights to Spider-Man for years without actually doing anything about it by making, you know, half-baked bullshit movies and whatnot. Like, it's not about doing something good. It's about paying less for the thing that's inevitably going to be bad. And this, in that case, it's just let her sit in a room and pretend like she's in charge. Honestly, that may have been her thing to begin with. Like, she and I'm not saying this is the case. I'm not saying this case. Big disclaimer. But if you were to be like, hey, let's put up a puppet diversity hire.
Yeah, you sound like Chris. I like your take with the stock stuff. The problem is we there is no quote unquote Xbox stock. It's just Microsoft, you know?
No, I know. And that's even worse. Like, think about it, okay? Let's say she's making $300,000 a year, right?
Yeah.
How much bad word does Microsoft have to get? Like, how much stink has to get on Microsoft for them to lose $300,000 worth of stocks? That's just a fart in the wind, right? Somebody looks sideways at somebody else. Like, so if you look at it through that context, absolutely them replacing her would cost them more than $300,000 in value.
Yeah, it's just hard to parse because, like, other things are fucking up Microsoft stock right now. Yo, they have two versions of of Outlook on the Artemis, and they both fucked up. That's among other things, are making them look bad, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, it's cumulative, but that doesn't mean that it's not there. Like, again, when you're looking at a company as big as Microsoft and you start talking about them changing out their executive guard, that puts a level of non-confidence in a company that can move the needle on their stock quite a bit. So you're talking about a large amount of value shifting, which is statistically larger by volumes than the money that they're probably paying her. Again, it's even hypothetically, it would be one of those, like, it's just cheaper and easier to leave it this way, because if you don't, it could be a PR nightmare. It could be, it's not that far off. Like, there are lots of companies that keep nightmare employees because it's worth, it costs them less to keep them employed than it would to fire them.
Yeah. We're not saying she's a nightmare employee, but that is a good point.
No,
go ahead.
Yeah. No, I'm just saying that, the motivation to those are both the same in the sense that the motivation is let's spend less money. How do we do that? Not does this person deserve the job? And that's inevitably, unless they bring somebody else in who's going to want to do it. But honestly, if she's kind of the head of Xbox and Microsoft is dog walking Xbox around the parking lot, is it really much more than a kind of empty throne?
Yeah, I don't know. Carlos, it looked like you wanted to say something.
Yeah, just to piggyback a point that you made. The last 3 months, Microsoft's lost nearly $1 trillion worth of stock.
Fuck.
Or valuation, at least. So that's a lot of Asha Sharma's. I don't know how they'll quantify that, but because Xbox is such a small piece of what Microsoft does, it seems more like a pet project at this point.
I always said it's a side hustle. Yeah, you know.
Yeah, it's a side hustle for them. So I don't know. I don't know how. Like, the only way that I see her, you know, being canned in the next year or two is if public facing wise, she messes up.
Mm.
Like, she says something dumb or I don't know, gets arrested or something. I don't know, something like that.
Yeah. The heart of the question is really, how long should gamers give her until they're like, okay, bitch, what are you doing for Xbox? I think that's the heart of the question.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I agree with the 5 years.
That's where I can understand Brett's point with the 2 years as well.
Yeah, no, exactly. I agree too. All right, last question of the night, but this one we're probably going to be on for a little bit because it is a subject we have talked about, and it seems to happen every single time a prominent game from the East comes out. I think you know what the question is already. This one is from Gaming Engineer, aka Alpha Chuck. And let me finish this question because I know someone's going to want to answer as soon as I ask the first part. Does it feel like the Western gaming media has some inherent bias against Crimson Desert or smaller Asian developers in general? I understand reviews are subjective, but I struggle with all the negativity Crimson Desert has undergone in the media, especially when those who have played it say mostly positive things. when you take into account that these are the same reviewers who gave the likes of Concord, Dragon Age Veilguard, and Highgarde better scores. Gee, this sounds like a familiar place we've been in. Remember when Stellar Blade came out? The same thing happened, right? Korean game comes out. Players love it. Westerners shit on it. And it's not just a new thing. This is something we've been talking about on Throwdown since the very beginning. And you could even go back further. Look at the way, and you know, shout out to X-Play. X-Play's fun. Look at the way they treated Japanese games compared to, you know, Western games, right? Very different. Mm-hmm. There's always, that bias has always existed, right? At least it's really starting in like the early 2000s when Western games started getting more prominent than Japanese. Because obviously this wasn't happening during the 80s and 90s. All you were playing were Japanese games. But like in the early 2000s, you started seeing that shift. And Manny and I caught that real quick. We talked about this way before we even had this stupid podcast. You know, like, hey, what the fuck? What's up with this media? Like, you know?
Like we have your shit like Chad Grimgravy and stuff like that and all that other, like, there's actually a really, like, a mega cut of all the, and let's just be honest, racist bullshit that X-Place was spewing. But it's obviously, you know what they're doing. They're trying to be that sort of punk rock, like, hey, man, we're better than you. Like, yeah, let's do it. Like, I think I think that's where it really sort of comes from. A lot of that sort of what I would call Western hubris.
Yeah.
When it comes to, you know, it's all, you know, art, you know, instead of those things. But like, yeah, I think in general, no, you're not wrong in thinking of that. I definitely think here's the interesting thing. I don't exactly know where it comes from when it comes to like Korea. I can get the, at least because we also, a lot of us grow up in the generation like, you know, after Vietnam, after all that sort of stuff. And there's definitely this sort of, especially in the United States, there's this sort of harshness that comes with when it comes to talking about Japan. Could be the Pearl Harbor, could be all of that, you know, what happened during the war, that all of that sort of passed down through our parents, through us, through all of that.
Movies. Sort of, you know,
through movies, because if you look at films too, they're very, you know, obviously, I'm not saying that any of that, those events were awful, you know, also Hiroshima and all that stuff. I'm not saying any of that stuff was awful, but I think that there's also that sort of anger that sort of perpetuated itself through culture, American culture.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. What do you say,
Carlos? So,
yeah,
definitely. I mean,
so, and I feel like that still exists to an extent. When it comes to Japanese games, but I don't exactly know where that would come from with something like Korean game, where obviously Korea in general hasn't really, like, South Korea has been an ally. They've always been on our side. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, you talk about Korean War, that's, you know, North Korea and South Korea. So I don't understand where that sort of mentality comes when to that sort of thing. And I feel like I see it that happens with, obviously, with Chinese games as well. But it's like there's this weird mentality that somehow Western culture knows better than all these other people. All they make. And this is just, you know, this is what I at least see them saying. It's like, all they know how to make is titty games. All they know how to do is do these other sort of things. It's like, well, they obviously seem to have a somewhat of an understanding of their audience. And they also seem to believe that there is more than one audience to sell to. We see it with Demon's Souls. You know, see it with the Souls game, where the backlash came from that. Oh, game.
Oh, yeah, that's another one.
That are too fucking hard. You see it with, you know, obviously with a game like a Stellar Blade, where they're essentially doing sort of an old school, like, action game, you know, like Bayonetta and all that stuff, sort of in this, you know, in this world. You see it with Nier Automata, even though it was a well liked game, you still hear that background to it. So, I mean, it's going to keep on cropping up. You know, as long as these things exist. And I don't know if there's any, I wish that people would just be professionals and just, you know, and just look at these games as things that are, you know, specifically going for an audience and seeing, you know, essentially treating it like, I would say, like the way Tony treats these things. You know, he said multiple times, there are certain games that he's reviewed that he personally did not like, but that's not the thing that he is doing the review on. He's doing the review on what the game is doing, you know, what he sees the game doing.
Yeah, and I give him good scores. Shout out to Mr. Danny Pena in the chat. What's going on, brother? No, you're right about that. And again, this is a subject we've constantly keep talking about. But the thing is, it's selective too, right? You don't see Nintendo getting this kind of scrutiny. You don't see Pokemon getting this kind of scrutiny, you know?
It's a different story when it comes to a different genre. I also think that Nintendo has such a lock-in in our society that it's sort of beyond that sort of thing. And then you also notice that they don't seem to get any of that criticism because they're not looking for that audience. They're still doing kids games.
Yeah, right. That's true. Yeah. Go ahead, Carlos.
Yeah, I'm trying to. I know what you guys are talking about because you know we know some people that don't really like take kind into games that come from the East, and for very stereotypical ways as well. But I don't know because. The question asked about the review scores, and I think, I mean, review scores are kind of hit and miss with these types of games, because I know Resident Evil Requiem did really well, but the Crimson Desert, I think, had in the 70s, right, if I recall.
Yeah, he's not really saying the review scores. You're right, it is in the upper 70s, but he's really talking about the actual reviews themselves, not the scores. You know, like the way they talk about the game. Again, this is a subject we've gone on and on about every time one of these big games comes out, you know. But he's really talking more about the reviews themselves, not the score.
Okay. So could it be that a lot of the criteria with these types of games, because Stellar Blade did this, the Wukong game, but the Wukong game kind of went into sort of a bigger culture war type of narrative for some reason. Yeah. So that one's kind of, you know, separate to for example Crimson Desert, but I guess maybe for this game and maybe some other games that are similar, maybe it's their lack of narrative that people don't really take, it doesn't really fancy them.
Lack of narrative, but then you, like Manny mentioned, different kind of narrative. So I think you're onto something there too, potentially.
Yeah, and like Manny mentioned, there's these games like the Nintendo games that don't have narratives that for the most part they're really basic. But you know, those are drenched in nostalgia, and you know, Japanese games for the most part do have a past. And I do feel like a lot of it is older generations, that are going through that. I feel like younger generations don't really have those same stigmas, even about things like China, you know, like China's perception has changed drastically just in the last 10 years. Cause when we were growing up, it was a lot different. So I feel like a lot of that's changing.
But I also think that that's also and I think with Wukong, that was, I think, China essentially trying to break out of the misconception, the general world idea of them being the bootleg country.
Yeah.
Where a lot of their things are just knockoffs of other things. But then you also sort of see that sort of coming back to sort of bite them in the ass. Whereas let's say Wukong was a showcase of their culture, you know, their stories, and then also the skill of the different aspects of it. Like, you know, they had three Chinese animation studios doing cinematics for them. They were essentially doing a whole big showcase. But then you have what we start to call the Wu game.
Other Chinese
studios see that this thing is doing well. Okay, so now we're going to do our own version, own sort of like Wukong like, because those things are doing well elsewhere.
I'm just laughing because that's we're gonna have to just call it that, the Wukong like.
Or the Wu likes.
The Wu like, yeah. I mean. We know, you know what those kind of games are when you see them, right? But it also may, you know, I mean, we could tangent off a bit since it's the last question, but it also makes me wonder how much, there's a term for it, where how much of this was happening at the same time concurrently without studios really talking too much to each other. You know how, like, when you had two volcano movies, two meteor movies, you know, like, there must have been some level of that, because, like, again, these games take a very long time to make. And just having one come out after the other, it seems to me there must have been some level, like some of these were being made at the same time, you know. But then again, we don't know how Chinese game development is, so maybe they were kind of talking to each other.
We don't know how Chinese game development is. That's the big difference between them, us, and you know, the West is they can kind of throw bodies at, which is,
yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. Oh, yeah.
Because they can have so many people they could probably throw onto staff and not really be paying amazingly.
Man.
You can kind of get out, like, I'm not saying I don't know how much people you would need to do a Wu game in 2 years, but it's probably a lot more possible in a place like China than it is
elsewhere in the West. I didn't think about that. It's 100%. Hold on, it just blew my mind. You're right. That's how they're getting these games out so fast. I don't think they have the media over there. You know, they don't think they have a Jason Schreier talking about crunch over there. You know,
there's no. I mean, if you look at the way the factory system is over there, you also don't, you know, get a lot of that in the news, but you do get a little bit inklings of that where people are essentially working in factories, built, you know, thousands, maybe billions of people working in these factories making iPhones. And then you hear stories about them doing things to themselves so that they can get the money for their family. There's all these sort of, there's all this really awful sort of stuff behind this over there. So who's to say that they're essentially making sweatshop.
That's a good point.
We don't know. We don't know.
Yeah.
We don't know for sure. But it is definitely a possible.
Yeah.
Take that. Yeah. I don't know about that. But what I do know is companies in the U.S. are much more incentivized by profit than over there. Over there, it's like if the government tells you to do something, you do it.
Yeah, you have to. That's it. Yeah.
Yeah, and also not to mention the government over there has a stake in every single company that exists over. And if they see this as some sort of invest, there's a lot more to it than that. But I would say for a place like Korea, I would say, I mean, it's funny. Also, Korea is also actively investing in video games. That's actually that was a news report fairly recently.
Yeah, that's what's up, Brett? You want to say something, bro?
Oh, that's just your dog.
Does your dog want to say something?
I don't think so. She's kind of ignorant.
Yeah. Shout out to Brett's dog, though. Yeah, Manny, to your point, I think that's just part of their soft cult, like soft power push. There's actually a name for it, Korean. They started this initiative like maybe 10 years ago. This where, you know, K-pop comes from, K-dramas, and they've been very successful, obviously. So I think the video game push is also part of that, you know?
Yeah.
Because we're seeing a lot more Korean games. Thank you. That's it. That's the term. Yeah. It's part of that.
What is that called?
Aliyah.
Yeah. 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 That's exactly it. Go ahead, bro. As someone who's been to Korea, you know.
Yeah, I mean it's always, you know, it's a wave to push you know their culture and exporting culture as part of, you know, selling it to the world. Where K-pop is probably one of the biggest in terms of music industry. K-dramas are super popular, really huge. Even, you know, beauty and food and all that stuff, like all that super popular, even movies. I mean, one of them won an Oscar like a few years ago.
Oh, shit.
So there's
K-pop Demon Hunter just won something. I mean, granted, not a real Korean production, but it is taking advantage of that.
Yeah. So there's, you know, there's a push to these kinds of things. And you know, Korea, they have like some games that you wouldn't expect them to, like PUBG is a Korean game.
Yeah,
Lies of P is also a Korean game.
There's a lot of Korean games. Crimson Desert, obviously, Stellar Blade. I think it's cool, man. Let's go. You know, go ahead.
Personally, I like seeing, you know, because again, like we're so inundated with a bunch of stuff from Japan. It's nice to see something from another Asian. And I also said the same thing when it came to the Chinese games, where it's like it's nice to see something other than the usual. Hey, it's a samurai.
I agree.
We have a wushu swordsman. We have these sorts of different cultural things, and it's nice to sort of see that. What does what their idea of what a video game it should be, you know?
Yeah, I agree with that. But yeah, again, you know, we see this far too often, and there's going to be another big Eastern game that comes out sometime next year, and we're going to be back here again. Talk about this same subject, you know?
Yeah, to me, it's I don't know. It's a weird, I don't know, understand what it is. Where it's like, okay, now, oh, well, hey, here we have these guys coming in here with their games. I'm like, that was when it came to Japan, that was the only games most of them enjoyed. If you're from the Nintendo generation, that you played, yeah, the majority of the games you played were Japanese games.
Well, but I will say this, they did do a good job at masking,
yes,
their Japanese side, because Mario, someone playing Mario, most of them had no clue that the game was Japanese.
Oh yeah, and then also the other thing that tends to happen when things were brought over is they sort of whitewashed them, right? You know, Ash Ketchum is supposed to be called Satoshi, right? All of that stuff got whitewashed into hey, this is Barry, this is Jim. They gave them obviously Americanized or Western sounding names.
Yeah, what's now, Brock's real name? You know, yeah. Is it Akira? Yeah. You know,
we have now people obviously get, because it's all out in the open. You can't get away with saying, hey, Crimson Desert is something like a Stellar Blade isn't an Asian game. Like, you know, yeah. They changed her main name even though her name is Eve, but they give her something like that. It's harder to get away with that sort of thing, to try to mask it as a thing. But I also noticed that, like, you see two examples of Korean games that are very Westernized. Like Crimson Desert is like, he's like Irish, isn't he? Or like, it's some sort of like,
no, it's very, like, it's at least initially, very Western European fantasy. Yeah,
it's a very Western sort of, and then we have Lies, which is feels very French,
yeah,
but uh-huh. it is definitely, most definitely Korean title. I didn't know that game was Korean, to be honest. Lies,
I didn't know either. I had no idea. I didn't know
either.
I think I learned it on this show. I'm like, excuse me,
yeah,
you know. But yeah, anything else you guys want to say about this topic that we've discussed many, many times before?
Yeah, I guess the next time, like you said before, the next time something big that comes from Asia comes over, we're gonna probably hear very similar sort of sentiment. It's very interesting to see people that call themselves very sort of conscious about the diaspora of peoples being so very heavy-handed when it comes to talking about the cultures of these specific the cultures of Asia.
Yeah, no, you're right. Man, I'm telling you, there's gonna be one day, bro, you know, after I retire, I'm gonna write a tell-all book. I'm gonna name names, man. I'm gonna say that. I'm gonna name names.
It's hypocritical. It's like, why are what like, if we're supposed to, if we respect all cultures, if we respect all the different voices, then what makes this any different?
Yeah,
why? You're right. Why are some things okay to give a pass to, but some things aren't? When you're essentially doing the same sort of thing, I don't know.
Man, you're right. Man, you're right. Go ahead, bro.
Animal Farm. Everyone is equal, but some are more equal than others.
Oh fuck. So, yeah. Brian, what are your thoughts, man?
Again, I've just been listening to the conversation, and again, I have noticed it, but again, it's always just a case of why some games are not other games. And that's like the weird thing. And it just really confuses me. And it leads me back to something I seen on Twitter once, where this is back when Wukong was doing really well and everyone was touting the Steam numbers. And then people were saying like, yeah, it's only big because people in China like it. And I'm like, okay, like, I don't understand that idea. And like, surely that's a good thing. You have a game that people like. You have a game that certain people from a certain region are enjoying and like it. I don't understand that as a bad thing, you know? It's like saying this game is only big because people in America like it. It's like, okay, that's fine. That's great. That's what you want. But again, I just don't understand this weird negativity towards games of that region. Again, I honestly cannot place the reason why. I know some people want to talk about, okay, it's maybe like surface level of racism, but I think there's a bit more to it because it just doesn't make sense. Like, because if it was surface level, then it'll be across the board, right? It'd be all games from this region is automatically a no, but it's not all games, it's some games. So what's up with that? Again, I would love to be behind the scenes and listen in, because I'm sure that behind the scenes they will let you know, or in the private group chat they would let you know the reason why they don't like these games.
I've said this in the past, and I'll bring it up again. One of the, because again, Brian, like you said, we don't really know, so we can only just speculate. And I don't think it's just one answer. I think it's multiple. And maybe some answers are not as like weighted as some of the others. But you know, one of the other things that could be it is like when it comes to Western game journalists, it's very easy for them to, you know, easily talk to Western game developers, right? They're right there. They could, you know, hobnob and everything. And they may not want to say anything too harsh, potentially harsh against somebody they may consider a friend. But if you have a game developer in Japan that you don't talk to so often, it might be easier to criticize harder. Again, I'm not saying that's the reason. I'm saying that could be a reason, you know, because they're over there. You know, these guys are over here. So it's they have
non-Sony.
Like a, not Sony, because we don't speak about that incident with Insomniac. But then again, Insomniac also a game Western game developer, right? But you are right. But it goes back to, you know, Brian's point. Final Fantasy doesn't get this stuff, right? Nintendo doesn't. But I think there is some grandfathering going on. A lot of people grew up with Nintendo, like Manny, like you said, they masked it. People don't consider it Japanese, even though it is, you know? And Final Fantasy was also heavily westernized back in the day. Remember, they even had the wrong numbers, you know? Oh, I love Final Fantasy II. You know, that's the fourth one, right? You know, stuff like that.
Also, you know, when it came to Final, because RPGs didn't do amazingly well.
That's they did not.
They sort of skipped ones, and they just kept the same numbering. Like, okay, this is the last one we release here. We'll just call it 3 because we didn't release the other two here.
And then, ironically enough, Final Fantasy "quote unquote" 3 was very. It sold very well. It was one of the first big RPGs like that. I mean, in the West, obviously in Japan, Dragon Quest was the one that blew up.
There was also like the fact that, like, you know, things like Chrono Trigger sort of opened the door.
That's another one.
Stuff like that, a Secret of Mana, where it's sort of less turn-based.
Yeah, remember SquareSoft? That was a good company.
Yeah, SquareSoft. That was a good company.
I miss them. Oh man! All right, man. I think that's gonna do it for us. Oh, what's up? Unless you have something else to say.
Real quick. And I haven't really thought this all the way through, but could it also be like games that are unapologetically, you know, Eastern, either Japanese, Chinese, Korean, the ones that probably suffer the most? Because, you know, what's it called? Stellar Blade is one of them for sure.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we saw the whole thing with the actress and stuff, the main character. Wukong, it has to do with their greatest, you know, probably their most influential work, you know. So, and with Japan, it's like most of the games that, you know, that most people talk about, it's the Marios, it's the Final Fantasies, it's the Kojima games, the Metal Gears, you know, that I feel like people don't really see anything other than, you know, just the characters. You know, that maybe that's why, you know, games like Yakuza didn't blow up like mega big in the West. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good point. All right, let's start wrapping up here. And by the way, I'll tell you this off here. I think I figured out what was... Carlos, nothing happened with the stream, right? By the way, I think we were good.
We good.
All right, but I think I know what happened. So I'll tell you off air. But actually, I'll tell you now. I kept getting this message from OBS saying encoding overload. I'm like, oh, I don't like that sound. And I have noticed, for example... The CPU usage has been 14%. When I stream on my PC, it's usually 1%. And every time I open up a Chrome browser, it's like 25, 30%. I'm like, oh, shit. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at my other settings, but I believe I just got to lower the resolution because I have it at 1080p. I think I may originally have it 720p. Again, this is an audio show, basically. Nobody here is here to look at our pretty faces, you know, so I'll lower it and shit.
All two of us.
All two of us. That's right. Motherfuckers don't see us. All right, let's start wrapping up. Let's plug some stuff. I'll start first, and this will lead to Rich. The Invincible Podcast is back. I think we recorded one of our best episodes this weekend, probably because it was one of the best episodes of the season or even the series. So make sure you head over to the Coalition Entertainment YouTube channel. Check that out. Lots of fun. It's me, Rich, Carlos, Chris, and Dana talk about the Invincibles. And we're on every single week until the season finale, which I expect will be another banger. So check that out.
Do you also talk about the controversial subject matter of the changing of a specific character?
Yeah, we brought it up. Okay. The general consensus is, and even from the combo guys, Manny, I said this on air. I'll say it to you. I'm sorry, Manny. I didn't read Tech Jacket, so I don't care about that character. It's like, you could change him or whatever, you know. But I agree. Will. It makes sense to. You're gonna have another guy that looks exactly like Mark. Like, I get it. Yeah, I get it.
as a person who worked on the Tech Jacket comic series, I am fine with the change, just because of the fact that both Mark and and Tech Jacket in their people forms kind of look like duplicates of each other. And I've even said it on a Twitter post, if you guys want to read that, where I felt like sometimes I felt like we were doing Invincible Junior when we were doing Tech Jacket, even though we were trying to legitimately push the differences between the two.
Yeah. By the way, Manny, now that thankfully Twitter shows me your stuff, I did read that post. It was a very good post. But yeah, go check out the Invincible Podcast and check out Invincible. Do yourself a favor. Show's amazing. Rich, what else is coming up on the Coalition this week?
Yeah, so like you said, Tony, Invincible Podcast, phenomenal episode. Definitely check that out. Shout out to Mr. Adam Vale, the TV Terminal. He is still going to be reviewing several of the shows that he has been covering, so stay tuned for that. As for the Coalition Gaming side, I'm working on several things that I cannot talk about whatsoever.
Uh-oh.
So all I can say is stay tuned to thecoalition.com, stay tuned to the Coalition Gaming, and you may see some stuff sooner rather than later.
Yeah, that's a very pragmatic answer. I like that.
You're beating by 1 second.
Oh, man. Oh, man, what's going on in your world?
Right now it's relatively quiet on the Western front. I am working on a couple of quite a bit of projects that I cannot talk about currently, but it's a lot of fun stuff that's going to be coming down the line, and I hope you enjoy it. Right now, as of now, I don't have any sort of announcements as far as like shows I'll be at. Obviously, like most comic conventions, you gotta sort of wait until they sort of pull you out of the lottery and say, hey, I'm going to be in your town. But I did apply to a few more conventions this year. Hopefully I'll get in, and hopefully I can see you guys come to your town. Bring a little bit of throwdown magic to your town.
The world tour.
Yeah, the world tour.
All right. Good stuff, man. Let's wrap it up. So make sure you follow Throwdown on Twitch and Twitter. Follow us on YouTube. Check us out on Discord. And also follow us on your favorite podcast app. Links to everything down below. Once again, I was your host, Tony Polanco. And tonight, I was joined by Emilio Lopez.
See you next time.
Carlos Romero.
Peace out.
Brett Murdoch.
Deuces.
Richard Bailey Jr.
Have a good week, everybody.
And Brian Manjoma. Uh-oh. Brian, where you at?
I was on mute. Sorry. Thank you, people.
All right, guys, we shall return on Thursday later.
Peace.
Later.
This is...